that are public costs and risks confidential. But this new technology is really not all that new compared to the destroyed Deepwater Horizon rig. These floating fossil fuel collectors are like industrial cities loaded with explosive flows. There are usually over 100 workers on board a platform, but I don't know how much they've automated it on this new Chevron rig. It was built by the same company that produced the Deepwater Horizon for BP, Transocean. Chevron called for a new design and is the operator. Let's do just a couple of comparisons. Chevron says its rig can go down 34,000 feet below sea level. The Deepwater Horizon, let's call it DH sometimes, also claimed to drill down to 30,000 feet or about 9,100 meters. Not a big difference. The DH was drilling at a depth of about 20,000 feet when the explosion occurred, leading to the largest marine oil spill in the world. Chevron also makes a big deal about their advances in all-electric operation. This supposedly reduces risk of mechanical failures routine with older hydraulic control systems. Sometimes a human turning a mechanical valve saves disasters, I have to remind us. Electronic systems can fail due to lack of electricity, circuit failures, flooding, computer breakdown, and hacking. Could the safety measures be turned off by a hostile government? The electricity comes from onboard big diesel generators, not green power. Chevron says it has increased the amount of pressure their machinery can withstand from about 15,000 pounds per square inch on the Deepwater Horizon to 20,000 pounds PSI for the new Chevron anchor. The company claims to have redesigned the crucial blowout preventer that failed in the Deepwater Horizon back in 2010. In 2010, no one had submersibles with technology to fix that deep-sea blowout. Is that tech ready now for the next accident? I mean, this is really all accumulated old rig technology with some polishing and some new steps, maybe some stronger metals. We have to take Chevron's word for it. It's untested. Who knows what will happen? We'll find out. And if these new frontier deep rigs work out as planned and there is no disaster, it's still a disaster for world climate and all of us. As Johan Rockström warned, we are already outside some planetary boundaries and rapidly heading to irreversible tipping points. To survive for coming generations, humans need to make deep sea bed into a protected area. No more fossil fuels.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
Experts may underestimate human risk during extreme heat, especially as Earth reaches the hottest temperatures in more than a million years. And beyond bare survival, what do we need to really live for basic household tasks or even physical work? A new study warns we are not protecting the most vulnerable. This includes babies, seniors, the unhoused, and other risks you may not know about. We have the ideal guest to explain. Professor Ollie Jay is director of the Heat and Health Research Incubator. That's at the University of Sydney. He is a co-author of the paper published November 29, 2023, in Nature Communications. It's titled, A Physiological Approach for Assessing Human Survivability and Livability to Heat in a Changing Climate. From Sydney, Australia, Ollie Jay, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
You just had your first early season heat wave in Australia. Absolute temperature records were set last week in China and Korea in what should be the start of their winter. People all around the world experienced extreme heat this year. How would you introduce the purpose of your new heat study?
Well, I think it's important for people to first not just focus on temperatures. So obviously the ambient temperature, which is measured in the shade, is an important consideration. But if we think about the way in which the human body interacts with the environment in order to try to keep cool, one of the other key aspects is the humidity of the air and the ability to sweat. And it's the evaporation of that sweat into the surrounding environment that is the most potent way in which humans keep cool. So when we're thinking about the threat to human health now and the threat to human survival in the future, we need to think not only about temperature, but we need to think about humidity.
For over a decade, experts warned the limit for human survival was around 35 degrees C, measured by something called the wet bulb temperature. What is that, and how was that limit established?
Okay, so it's a 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature threshold. So the best way to think about it is if you have a thermometer and you wrap that thermometer in a wet cloth, and then if water from that wet cloth evaporates, it will reduce the temperature of that thermometer. Now, at 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature, it's basically equivalent to 35 degrees Celsius with 100% relative humidity. And at that particular point, there is no heat transfer between the body and the surrounding environment. So we transfer heat between the body and the environment through two predominant pathways. One is called sensible heat transfer via radiation and convection, which is dependent on a temperature difference between the outside of the body, so the surface of the body, and the air. And so when we're fully vasodilated, so we're fully responding to a heat stress, that skin temperature reaches a maximum of around about 35 degrees Celsius. So when air temperature reaches 35 degrees Celsius, there's no temperature difference, so there's no sensible heat loss. But we still have the evaporation of sweat, provided that sweat can evaporate. But if our skin is 35 degrees Celsius and we're fully saturating the skin with sweat and the air is fully saturated with water at 35 degrees Celsius, there is now no humidity difference between the skin and the air, and therefore none of the sweat can evaporate. So basically, all this to say that when we reach a 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature condition, we no longer lose any heat from the body to the environment, and we're constantly generating heat inside the body through cellular processes, which is a part of metabolism. If we can't get rid of any of that heat, we just basically accumulate that heat inside the body to the point where we cook to death. An important thing to keep in mind is that 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature can be achieved through a variety of different combinations of temperature and humidity. So while you get a 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature, 35 degrees Celsius and 100% humidity, you also get it at, let's say, 43 degrees Celsius and 60-plus relative humidity.
As your paper explains, there are two approaches to estimating heat risk. One is to measure actual excess deaths within a few days of the heat wave, basically epidemiology. But that assumes a developed health system that recognizes heat-induced mortality and keeps records, and that's not the case in many hot, humid parts of the world. How does your physiological method work?
Well, the physiological method is not necessarily keeping count of heat deaths. It's basically placing the human body at the center of this model for assessing what the risks are going into the future. So this is really important because the problem from a health perspective is the hot person in the hot environment, not necessarily just the hot environment per se. And so we can find different ways in which we cool people in a warm environment through different processes. But in this particular case, what we're doing is saying, okay, well, if we do reach a 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature condition, how does that affect the human body? And are we actually overestimating the limits of survivability? And when you place the limitations of human physiology within the context of the environment that they're exposed to, what we find is actually we're overestimating the limits of human survivability. So in hot, humid conditions, we think that the limit for human survivability is a six-hour exposure to a wet bulb temperature of around about 33 to 33.5 degrees Celsius, so not too far away from the current limit that is being used. But what we find when we get to hotter, drier conditions is that the limitation to the ability to keep cool is no longer the humidity in the environment, it's the ability to produce the sweat in the first place. And therefore, the limits for human survivability due to heat stress, if we're exposed for a six-hour period, are under much lower humidity conditions when that air temperature is much higher. So in this particular case, like I said, the limitation to thermoregulation is the ability to produce sweat in the first place, not the ability of that sweat to evaporate due to the humidity in the environment. And then when we start now integrating certain limitations to the ability to sweat, so you and I and anybody else who's just young, healthy, and fit, we still have a finite ability to produce sweat. What we know from physiological studies is that as we progressively age, particularly over the age of 65 and especially over the age of 75, the ability to sweat goes down quite dramatically because there are age-related decrements in the ability to sweat. So what we find is that this upper limit for human survivability, the threshold, if you will, is cooler and drier aging as well. So this is a really important consideration if we're thinking about the capacity for us to survive extreme heat across the human lifespan, not just the young, healthy people who have unlimited abilities to choose from.
Yes, as we learn, the heat limit is quite different for different ages. In a few minutes, we will hear about dangers for pregnant women and babies from your colleague, Professor Adrian Gordon, and Australian Dr. James Smallcomb will talk about children during heat extremes. Let's you and I go to those most endangered of all senior citizens. Do we know what percent of heat deaths are people over the age of 65?
Well, the epidemiological literature is very clear, is that we know that the risk of somebody either being hospitalized or dying during a heat wave is much more pronounced in people who are older. So people over the age of 65, certainly the risk is elevated substantially, and then that is even more pronounced over the age of 75. But one thing that's also important to keep in mind is that it's not just aging alone. So it's the combination of this physiological vulnerability with the levels of exposure that people are experiencing. And what we know is that people who have older age, they also have comorbidities such as heart disease or kidney disease, for example. That places them at greater risk physiologically. But if they also live in low-resource settings where they don't have access to mechanical cooling like air conditioning, they can't escape the heat, maybe they have limited mobility because that results in a reduced ability to engage in heat avoidance behavior, that really places people at the highest risk. So we shouldn't just be thinking about it along the lines of physiological vulnerability. We need to think about the behavioral adaptive capacity. And when you have those physiological vulnerabilities coinciding with low behavioral adaptive capacity, because the type of settings that people are finding themselves in and the resources that they have available to them to engage in cooling behavior, that's where it's the perfect storm of vulnerability.
At last official count, Australia has over 250,000 homeless people, and it's probably more in reality. They may not find shelter during the heat wave. Are the homeless a special category of social risk?
Absolutely. So, again, this speaks to that behavioral adaptive capacity. So people experiencing homelessness find it difficult to find shelter from extreme heat during heat waves. And actually, so a member of the Heat Health Research Incubator here at the University of Sydney, Dr. Tim English, is working with St. Vincent's Hospital and the City of Sydney here in New South Wales to develop mobile cooling hubs for people experiencing homelessness to ensure that they have access to shelter, they have access to cool spaces, but also evidence-based guidance on how to remain healthy throughout these periods of extreme heat. And that's a study that is underway this summer, and it's a first-of-a-kind one, as to the best of my knowledge.
Yes, that mobile cooling center hub was just announced by the University of Sydney.
It's the University of Sydney, so Tim English.
Gross survey that I did, a very quick look, seemed to indicate to me that Australia doesn't really have a full-blown cooling center network ready in case the power fails. Is that your take?
Well, I think that, first of all, we need to kind of think about what types of interventions actually work the best. So the evidence supporting the efficacy of cooling centers, certainly in an Australian context, it has not been demonstrated to date. What we find and what has been found is that people are quite reluctant to go to these cooling centres. Often they don't know where they are. People would much rather stay either at home or, you know, access other types of support rather than congregate in these cooling centres. So I think the evidence supporting the efficacy of those types of interventions is somewhat limited. And, of course, it may change depending on the type of setting that you're in. So perhaps something that works in a North American setting might not necessarily be as effective in an Australian setting. I think that's something we need to keep in mind before we start advocating necessarily for a large-scale rollout of cooling hubs.
But in 2009, the state of Victoria had a fairly large power outage. What happens when the grid goes down in Australia and all those air conditioners don't keep working?
Well, it's certainly something that is at the forefront of our minds, right? Because we know that the uptake of air conditioning is growing rapidly. We have a frail energy infrastructure, which is really stretched to its limits during periods of extreme heat where more and more people are reverting to using their air conditioning in order to remain cool. So it is a concern. So some of the work that we've been doing here at the University of Sydney is really looking at what type of simple strategies that people can use if they find themselves without electricity. So one type of strategy which we've been testing is looking at the efficacy of how you should best use water. Now, of course, drinking water is important for maintaining hydration, but you could also apply this water to the skin surface. And the evaporation of that water from the skin surface provides an extra cooling benefit. That's the type of strategy that is being advocated by public health organisations now for people who don't have access to air conditioning or don't find themselves in situations where they don't have access to electricity. Now, another thing that we also need to think about is how do we avoid these blackouts in the first place? Now, upgrading energy infrastructure is one thing, but that's a long-term solution. And it also doesn't really solve the problem of us consuming increasingly greater amounts of energy, which are predominantly generated by fossil fuel power plants. So that's a bit of a maladaptive situation that we're kind of finding ourselves in. So we've been working here at the University of Sydney alongside some of our colleagues in the US, trying to look at this idea of a fan-first cooling strategy. And this is where people use fans first, such as ceiling fans or pedestal fans, to blow more air across the skin surface. And what we can do is that cools the body more for a given air temperature. And if you do that first, then set your air conditioning unit to turn on this cooling at 27 degrees Celsius instead of 22 or 21 degrees Celsius. What we find is that people feel just as cool as they did at a cooler, stiller environment with the traditional air conditioning use right now. But the air conditioner turns on later in the day because it doesn't turn on until it exceeds 27 degrees Celsius. It turns off earlier in the day, and we find that that will reduce air conditioning use by about 70%, 70%. Reduces electricity consumption by 70% and places less strain on the grid. It also saves people on their electricity bill as well. So we look at this as being quite a simple, scalable strategy that will hopefully be adopted at scale and really help us build resilience into the community when we're looking at coping with these extreme heat events in the future.
Those are very useful tips. I'll put them in my blog as well. The Australian Council of Social Services found even before the summer begins, 74% of people on income support are cutting back on cooling and heating due to increasing energy costs. And that's the case, too, in America and in Europe. So there's definitely a socioeconomic aspect about who lives and who dies during extreme heat waves.
Absolutely, and I think that's something that is so important for people to keep in mind when we're having this discourse in the general public, is that often it's tempting for people to say, oh, well, you know, you just need to toughen up, cope with the heat. And what I think often these people are missing is that actually the most vulnerable are people not like themselves. They're people who have frail health, but they also find themselves living in quite tenuous circumstances. They don't have access to air conditioning. They don't necessarily have access to clean water. They may not have social cohesion. They may not be linked up with people in society. Often the most vulnerable are found dead at home, living alone on the top floor of a non-air conditioning apartment at the end of an extreme heat event. So the impacts of these types of events fall squarely on the most vulnerable and often the people who are least responsible for contributing to climate change as well. So this is something that's really important to keep in mind. It's also important to try to consider that when we're looking at this as a global phenomenon, is that if we're looking at the impacts of climate change with respect to extreme heat, particularly in lower middle income countries, predominantly tropical environments, again, the type of circumstances that people are finding themselves in there are often not comparable to your average Canadian, for example, your average American or your average Australian. So having that context is vitally important when we're thinking about the larger scale impacts of climate change on extreme heat.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
From Australia, Alex speaks with extreme heat expert Dr. Ollie Jay from University of Sydney.
We can't just focus on mortality. Everybody has to live, doing a job, getting groceries and all that. And about a quarter of the world population still has to work outdoors to grow crops. We recently heard from our guest, Dr. Connor Dunn-Diaz, about possible crop losses, meaning food shortages, when agricultural workers can't work outside. What did your team find out about limits to livability, and how do you define livability?
Well, in this particular case, in this study that you're referring to, we were really trying to look at it from a more holistic perspective. So the focus in the past has simply been how hot and humid does it have to be before people cannot survive the heat exposure. But what we then kind of reflected on is that in order for a region in the future to be inhabitable, it not only has to be survivable, it also has to be livable. And so to be livable, we need to take into account that people are going to need to engage in physical activities that require higher rates of metabolic heat production, and they may need to take into account clothing. We might need to take into account being out in the sun. You know, all of these limits to date have assumed that people are in the shade and that they're resting at minimal levels of activity. But in order to be livable, you need to be able to carry out simple daily tasks without risking exertional heat stroke. So in this particular study, we basically started to look at, okay, well, what type of levels of activity would be possible in these types of environments in the future, and is that sufficient to be livable? So not only are we looking at the limits of human survivability, we're also thinking about, okay, if it's survivable, what kind of activities are you still able to do in those environments? And what you might find is that under some circumstances, an environment might be survivable, but it's not livable because you can't really do anything in there. You just got to stay still, be nude, lying indoors in the shade, which is, you know, not the most of it. So we had integrated that type of analysis into the paper as well.
Did you find other places in the world that may be even more serious for these new findings of heat toleration than in Australia? Where else is this hot-humid combination going to make things either unlivable or unsurvivable even for a while?
I mean, what we found, and we didn't have an exhaustive climate analysis in this particular paper. What we're actually looking to do is we're now working on an analysis, a second paper that will contextualize these findings. But we did do a preliminary analysis that's included in that paper. And what we find is that the types of conditions where these really critical levels of temperature and humidity are experienced, often concentrated in lower middle-income countries, so these tropical regions. To date, what we know is that the 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature threshold is in all likelihood going to be exceeded somewhat regularly if the carbon emission scenarios moving forward do not change dramatically. But they'll be predominantly focused on areas such as the Indus River region, the Great China Plain, and places like that. But with this new model, what we expect is going to happen is that these critical limits of human survivability are actually going to be exceeded sooner under more modest carbon emission scenarios, and probably more widespread than just the limited areas that have been identified to date. But that's what this follow-up paper is going to focus on, illustrating.
The Australian Council of Social Services called the coming Australian months the horror summer, and the Australian Bureau of Meteorology predicts dire heat. With your expertise, Ollie Jay, when is it time to declare a climate emergency and get busy educating and preparing?
Well, the Australian Medical Association has already declared climate change as a public health emergency, and I think they know that the right signal. It is an emergency, and these very hot summers are already here, and so we need to do all we can to help particularly the most vulnerable in society to build resilience, to ensure that they can navigate their way through these extreme heat events safely. But it's also important for us to think about how we can build resilience among the community as a whole without contributing further to the problem down the line. And I think this is where the preoccupation with air conditioning, for example, is a real challenge, because it's often seen by many as a bit of a silver bullet. whereby, you know, as long as everybody has access to air conditioning, everybody will be okay. But the problem is, of course, is that air conditioning is very carbon intensive. At the moment, in many parts of the world, most electricity is generated by fossil fuel power plants. And so what we're finding ourselves slipping into is this vicious cycle where it's hot, we turn on our air conditioners to cope. Those air conditioners are powered by fossil fuel power plants, which belch out more CO2 into the atmosphere, which then contribute to warmer years in the future, which we respond to by using more air conditioning. And so we need to find a way of breaking that maladaptive cycle so we can get to the point where we have a sustainable and healthy path moving into the future.
Yes. Well, what does the Heat and Health Research Incubator do? And tell us about also your thermal ergonomics lab.
So the Heat and Health Research Incubator is a research center. What we do is serve as a platform to enable people from a variety of different disciplines, both within academia and outside of academia, working with the community, working with health, working with policymakers, working with industry, to develop comprehensive solutions to these very complex problems that we face in terms of the negative health effects of extreme heat on hot weather across the human lifespan. Within that, we have five priority research themes. We focus on maternal and child health, physical activity, occupational and sport, aging and chronic diseases. We also focus on two settings where we're developing solutions, so landscapes and the built environment and health, and also humanitarian settings. So that's how we organize all of our research activities. Nested within the Heat and Health Research Incubator, which is a center, is the laboratory which I direct, which is called the Thermal Ergonomics Laboratory. And so we have a state-of-the-art climate chamber within the laboratory where we have the capacity to simulate both heat waves of the past but heat waves of the future as well. So we go to the weather records from, say, the heat wave from Chicago in 1995. We simulate the temperature, the combination of the peak temperature and humidity. We then bring in human participants under safe medical supervision, of course, with a variety of different physiological profile. So we bring in people as old as 90 years old, children as young as 9. We expose them to these simulated extreme heat conditions, and we measure the effect that these extreme heat conditions have on their physiology. So we measure how hot it gets, how much work their heart has to do, how dehydrated they become. And then it gives us a means to identify systematically the efficacy of simple low-resource current strategies for reducing those markers of physiological heat strain that are ultimately responsible for making people ill when they're exposed to extreme heat. So we can test these simple strategies to identify which ones are the most effective at keeping people cool, which ones are most effective at limiting the amount of work people's heart has to do, and minimizing dehydration in some cases. So we do a variety of different studies in the lab. One of the other factors that we're doing now is trying to understand the limits of human survivability. So we have the capacity not only to simulate heat waves of the past, but also simulate the heat waves of the future. So the way that works is that we work closely with climate scientists who have a really strong understanding of the way in which the choices that we make now can contribute to different climate pathways in the future. And so we can actually not wait until these heat waves in the future arrive. We can predict what they're going to be with the different carbon emission scenarios that we find ourselves on now and simulate those different visions of the future with human participants and show the consequences of what those different heat waves in the future are going to do to physiological heat strain and the risk that people will face in the future.
From Sydney, Australia, we've been speaking with Professor Ollie Jay. He's the director of the Heat and Health Research Incubator and co-author of a new estimation of real heat risks. You can find links to the paper and more notes in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.org. Ollie, thank you for the work you do and for speaking with us today.
Roger. Thank you, Gabriel.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. This was supposed to be my summer vacation. This summer, as scientists admit, they don't know what caused the jump in heat in 2023 and 24. Their papers, talks, and articles keep gushing out like an emergency fire hose. I'm tracking it all. I just spoke with two field-leading scientists this week, with more coming, all for our new Radio EcoShock shows. The new season begins September 11th. That sounds ominous, and it is. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.